Hello, my friends. Welcome back. Welcome back. Welcome back. I am your host, Alexa Wilkinson.
And I'm your co-host, Maya Fiorito.
Mrs. Drink History. So on today's show, we are going to be talking about post-prohibition life and escapism after prohibition and the cocktail culture. We're going to be interviewing co-author of Cocktails Across America, A Postcard View of Cocktail Culture from the 1930s, 40s, 50s. Ann Davis. We're going to be interviewing her. So today, Mia and I, we have our respective drinks in our own homes. So let's do a little cheers. Happy Women's History Month. Chickadee
yes,
cheers.
Yes, ladies.
Cheers.
Whew.
I'm drinking whiskey with a splash of bitters.
Yum. And I'm having a white wine.
of the white grape blend. Smells.
And I'm having like a white
robot's bathwater.
Yeah. Delicious.
So today we're going to be talking about escapism, and Lord, do we need it? Yeah. Do we need some escape?
Even right
We've
now.
We've been trapped. Oh my God. We've been trapped in our apartments, houses. But anyway, escapism. So we all like to escape. We all like to be somewhere else, especially after times are really tough. And I know we're all going through it right now. And I feel like there might be a resurgence of this. Fun fact, Mia and I both hail from Beacon. I'm not from here originally, but Mia is. And there is a bar literally across the street from us that opened right before the pandemic hit. And it's an arcade bar. And we were so excited. But in the first week of COVID, they still had their games operational, but they separated them. And then someone complained and they got shut down. And so they haven't been able to have their games open this entire time, this whole year.
Such a terrible timing for a bar
to
open.
It's so bad. But I'm just like, we're waiting and praying and hoping for the day when they finally turn their games back on, because I just think we all need that release. Mm-hmm. And post-prohibition life was very similar to what I think we're all feeling right now. So we can all have empathy and sort of put ourselves in the place of people back then who were not only going through a repeal of, you know, the prohibition of alcohol, but they were also coming out of a Great Depression, not even maybe 12 to 18 years prior, were going through a plague. So we're talking about like 1918, 1919, then you go into 1920, and then you have, this prohibition, and then you have 1930 come around, it's finally repealed, and we have this mentality of like, we finally get a chance to like go out and experience each other, and we have a little bit of extra money and a little bit of extra time on our hands, and there's like nothing else to do really coming out of this Great Depression but really try and experience something that we haven't been able to experience for years and years and years and years and years. Yeah. So when we look back at this time, I find a lot of compassion and a lot of similarities to what they went through back then.
It's so funny. I never even thought that. Like, that's a really cool thing to recognize, that we are kind of dealing with something that can kind of correlate to those times back then with the whole COVID situation. Not that drinking is taken away, but
no,
just the fact of anything, not being able to go anywhere. Yeah. Cheers. but having to have that, like, we're going to get into escapism, like that whole entire situation kind of going hand in hand to right now.
I can't wait for live music. I can't wait to like travel again. Mm-hmm. So I totally understand why people created these like grand bars and hotels and ballrooms and jazz halls just to like experience something outside of what they've been dealing with through decades, you know?
For sure. Absolutely.
Like we just talked about, like by the 1930s, it was clear that prohibition had become like a public policy failure. And the 18th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution had done little to curb the sale, the pr- production, consumption. Like, it just sucked. Like, people were still drinking, right? Mm-hmm. But people were drinking unhealthily. They were drinking in excess. They were drinking outside of the law, which meant that there was no regulation on what people were drinking. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of bad health effects. Crime flourished. Tax revenues withered. It was just an overall failure. And the U.S. stuck in the throes of the Great Depression. Money just trumped morals, and the federal government turned to alcohol to sort of quench its thirst for desperately needed tax money and also to kind of start to rebuild the economy. And interestingly enough, it put an estimated 500,000 Americans back to work by repealing prohibition. So we got people back to work. We got them their jobs back. We got people like back pushing money back into the economy. So we can feel that right now, like, right? Like, we're starting to open up back up businesses. Right. I'm not giving any cred over to Texas at all. I understand the need to reopen a state, but like, lifting a mask mandate is dumb. But anyway, side note, we're starting to reopen, you know, we're getting more and more capacity back up and similar to them. So back in the 1930s, but in February of 1933, Congress easily passed the proposed 21st Amendment that repealed the 18th Amendment. So the 21st Amendment, I don't know if anyone's had 21st Amendment beer, but that's what it's named after. And we have a lot of, you know, celebration around it. Even like the 17 out of the 22 senators who voted for prohibition 16 years earlier now approved the repeal. So they all saw the like how failed this was. Mm-hmm. State conventions quickly ratified, you know, on and on and on. And here we go. We're back into like a whole experience now of America having its cocktails back. So by the end of 1933, we had our cocktails back. In the legalist of senses, an abundance of new cocktails and mixed drinks survived the dark days, and cocktail bars returned to the limelight. In the 1930s, we saw like tiki culture was born, though it was really something that took off kind of after the return of World War II soldiers that had been stationed in the South Pacific. And we're going to do a whole tiki episode later, actually a tiki series about the cultural appropriation and the problematic nature of tiki, but it's something that we have to talk about when we talk about escapism, because this is a huge theme that people brought up. And by the late 1940s, cocktail guides were written for like every host or hostess wannabe and throwing cocktail parties, and complete with like savory and weird strange canapes. It was a very in thing to do. Some bartenders returned to America, others stayed abroad, but regardless of the location, many emerged as respected authorities and authors. And cocktails were influencing pop culture and vice versa. And corporate sponsorship became super common, with companies giving away pamphlets full of recipes. And you might be surprised at how many late like 1960s, 1970s books and pamphlets on astrology themed cocktails you can find. And Mia, you found an astrology cocktail book. Can you tell us about some of those cocktails?
So it's Zodiac Cocktails, Cocktails for All Birthdays, and it's by Stanley McNeil. And so he, in this book, he pretty much, if you look into it, I keep seeing this like pin of this like guy in a gown and a hat with all these astrological signs on him and like this huge telescope, and I think it just goes hand in hand with like one of the illustrations on the page of this book. But I'm trying to find more about this book, and it's more so on the pin that I'm seeing. It's so crazy, you really can't like find many pictures. But yeah, we did find we found the air sign, I think we found an earth sign page, a fire sign page, and an air sign. Yeah. So we haven't found water.
Any like water or.
Yeah, we didn't find water. So this guy is pretty much taking classic cocktail recipes and just, I think he's just like, let's just make a fun thing about it and like make it about zodiacs. You know what I mean? Like, so yeah. Like, for instance, Capricorn, one of their cocktails is called the Autumn Cocktail, and it's got half lemon juice or lime juice. Oh, actually, this, I've never heard of this before. And then I can't see, the picture's so blurred a little bit, but it's like, I think half Swedish punch, which,
yeah,
I don't think what I've ever Swedish had Swedish punch right?
Swedish punch.
I don't know. It's like, of course, I choose that one that I don't know what Swedish punch is. But there's all these different like cocktails. There's like brandy, cherry brandy, and like lemon juice, or I know that there was one that was very similar to just like a
Collins. I found Swedish punch.
It's
P-U-N-S-C-H. And it's a liqueur. It's very complex. It has intense aromas of allspice, clove, licorice, caramel, and dried oranges.
Whoa.
It's very molassesy, brown sugar, vanilla, like leather. It's very like dark.
Kind of, you know what it kind of reminds me of when you just describe it like that, besides the leather? Planter's punch.
It does. It does remind us of Planter's punch. So I think it's like Swedish punch took on its own little
thing.
You know, its own little thing. Okay, I'm sorry. Continue.
No, you're fine. So I'm reading the introduction of this book, like the first page, and the print is so, so small. But what I was reading this and I was like, okay. Like, so this guy is pretty much just making this book to make everybody feel like special for their astrological signs, and like you're gonna feel a certain way because, well, true, but it's like if you're an air sign. Okay, so I'm an air sign, I'm an Aquarius, and it says that those belonging to air signs, namely Gemini, Libra, and Aquarius, when they drink these cocktails, apparently they literally walk on air when under the influence of their birth cocktails. And then it keeps going. I love it. Those belonging to the fire signs, Aries, Leo, and Sagittarius, they go up in smoke when they drink these birth cocktails. And then the water one for Cancer, Scorpio, and Pisces. And I love how he writes, well, we can only say that when they cannot hold any more, they swim. I thought it's just so lame. It's like you can't hold any more liquor, so you're swimming at that point. I don't understand. It's like, oh, like I'm done. Yeah. And then
keep going.
But for your sign is my favorite, my absolute favorite. So everybody who is ever either a Taurus, a Virgo, or a Capricorn, just so you guys know, or ladies, or you know, whomever, when you drink your birth cocktails, you are earthbound. And in other words, you will usually move around on all fours. And that one just like put me over the edge. Like, so now that with these Capricorn cocktails, right? So let's say, hey, Capricorn, if you're going to be drinking a Capricorn cocktail, an equator cocktail, let's say, these are like the words, universe, oh, your favorite, Alexa, universe eggnog. You love eggnog. You guys are going to be on your fours. Climbing around the house, crawling around, doing your thing on all fours because you're earthbound at that point.
So his version of universe eggnog, by the way, is not like making an egg like mixture, like a, because normally when you make eggnog, you basically make like a very liquidy custard and then you end up putting alcohol into it. No. His version is a fresh egg.
Oh, God.
A tablespoonful of sugar.
Mm-hmm.
One. So when they say 1/4 glass of a brandy, I'm not quite sure like what they mean.
Just pour it in
guessing,
there.
Just pour it in there. But what I'm guessing is 1/4 ounce brandy, 1/4 ounce rum, mm-hmm. 1/4 ounce Madeira, and a half pint of fresh milk. And then you shake that. It's just, it seems so like just the sugar is not going to dissolve in the cold liquid. This seems like the grossest eggnog to me.
Yeah.
How dare you, sir? Rude.
How dare you?
Rude.
Nasty.
Okay, gross. So we have so many of these books, by the way. There are hundreds of books written that are talking about, like, serving at home, fine art of mixing drinks, famous recipes by famous people. Mm-hmm. Whiskey's in the Kitchen, The Lively Art of Cooking with Bourbon. We have all of these bartenders that have become authors that are just really trying to create a cocktail culture that stems from like literally having people over for dinner all the way up into these fantastical bars. And we found some really interesting themed bars. So actually we have, you know, we're going to talk more with Anne about themed bars that come up, especially a couple in particular. But Mia and I, through our research, found some old pictures that were inside American bars and lounges during the 1950s and the 1960s. This is like really at the height of cocktail culture. If you ever watched Mad Men, you have sort of this like imagery in your head of these like really muted pastels, people drinking out of martini glasses and these themed bars. But we found a couple that are really fun. There was one, Mia, we found the Underwater Bar.
I cannot with this bar.
In the Jules Verne room in the Marlin Bay Hotel in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I actually, and I correct me if I'm mistaken. I love it, but I do, again, with the movie trivia.
Oh.
The movie Analyze This with Billy Crystal and Rob De Niro.
I've never heard of it.
They end up at a hotel bar for his wedding, and I think they're at this hotel.
Really?
Because I think this bar still exists in this hotel in Florida.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Okay.
And I think that they filmed a scene in this bar.
That would be
amazing. I could be totally, totally wrong.
So in this picture, just so y'all... Oh, sorry.
We're going to post this on Instagram. So it'll be up.
There's like these three people that are sitting at this bar with like the classic leather or pleather freaking seats.
Red chairs, yeah.
Yeah, that like probably spin. The bar looks red, right?
It's very red. Like this, it's that like deep red ruby wood color.
Mm-hmm. And then
the bartender's jacket is red.
Is red. And he's, I love the seahorses just like at the top of the entire place.
Oh, yeah. Like that giant chandelier. There's seahorses that sort of ensconce it. And there's a bunch of seahorses. And then people like are in a tank.
Yeah.
Good for them.
Yeah.
Well, anyway. So we have these crazy bars, and there's another one that we found. There's a Viking bar in Sarasota, Florida, which doesn't really look too much like a Viking bar. I just think maybe it was shaped like a Viking bar outside. I'm not really seeing much. I do know that there were like Swiss-themed bars and restaurants where they did like really classic like Swiss chalet-style dining of like fondue. Fondue became a really big thing in the 1970s. There's a lot of dance halls.
Yeah.
There's a lot of jazz clubs.
I do see a lot of piano
bars. Yeah, a lot of piano bars. A lot of people dancing. A lot of people just really enjoying themselves outside of their house.
And I mean, drinking alcohol. So. I like this Purple Tree Lounge one in Rochester, New York.
Oh, yeah. Purple Tree Lounge.
That one's pretty good. It's got like, I'm sure they're fake trees, but there's like these purple trees. Of course. Everywhere, and like they have like the yellow chairs with the purple like complementary colors, so it's all poppy. I still love that. I love yellow furniture. Like I love green furniture, and I love like a good like mustard yellow accent chair. I'm trying to get very, one of those.
It's a very like vintage.
Yeah, I love it.
Color palette, which I love too.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we've got
that's great.
We've got this like fantastic decorating. We've got like beautiful like settings and scenery. We've got dance halls, piano bars, underwater bars, Viking bars. People are just like celebrating being able to go out and enjoy each other again, especially cuz now they got money coming in. Now they have the ability to drink alcohol outside. Like, wouldn't you want to go somewhere themed? I would.
100%. So,
also with that, in the middle part and later part of the 20th century, vodka and tequila, mezcal also, gained popularity, and rum, a liquor steeped in a dark history, returned from its dormancy. And all three joined gin, brandy, and whiskey, and the old triad of base spirits grew substantially. So, you know, we had more options for cocktails. We had more mixed drinks that we could create. We had more technology. We had new ingredients. So we not only had a resurgence of being able to drink, we had more things to drink and we had more things to mix it with. So we had just an unending amount of bartenders and club owners just creating these themed cocktails to go along with what they were doing. There are some fun, weird, and wonderful themed bars in New York City. So for all of our New York City folk, one of my favorites that I've been to, actually, when I first started dating my wife, we went to the Beetle Bar. Sorry, it's called Beetle House. I just call it the Beetle Bar for absolutely no reason. but it's Tim Burton themed. So it's a lot of Nightmare Before Christmas, a lot of Beetlejuice. A lot of his drawings are up there. A lot of his art, like everything from one of his movies is up there. It's so fun. I don't know if they're still open, but it's really, really fun. If you can go there around Halloween, it's super worth it.
I would love to go there.
Yeah. It's so fun.
I love
fun.
Tim Burton.
Yeah, I do too. there's a couple others. Let's see. Beauty Bar is one. Mm-hmm. You can, it's very like vintage salon. You can go and get a martini and a manicure at the same time. Mm-hmm. They have burlesque shows sometimes. What's another one? Apotheque is one. It's really good. Holiday Cocktail Lounge, which I really love. It's sort of a dive bar, but it's got like vintage whimsy to it.
The first bar that I ever actually that I ever heard of was Rolf's, and I know I keep bringing it up, but if you Google Rolf's NYC, like, it's a Christmas bar, and I am a sucker for Christmas. I'm not a sucker for Christmas as in it's my favorite holiday, but I whenever Christmas comes around, like going to the city and like seeing those lights and all like these ornaments, it really is a really magical thing in New York City. But
yeah,
this,
agree with that.
Right? I love New York at Christmas time.
Yeah, Christmas in New York is amazing. That's why they have
great.
So many movies about it.
Yeah.
They've got probably a movie called Christmas in New York.
Yeah.
I wrote a song with my bandmate Jesse called Christmas in New
York.
Well, see, that's the thing. We talk about these bars, and I feel like as much as I love my neighborhood dive, I love me a themed bar.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the escapism that hospitality creates. And I think the reason that even when I was back in the 2000s, trying to get a job at a bar, I remember loving hospitality for the escapism quality of it. And I remember my first time like really serving people. And it was not when I was a bartender so much at my first job, because that bar was atrocious. But when I worked at the Ginger Man as a server there, and I made some of the best friends of my life there. I had incredible connections with customers. I loved being able to, through education of a product that I was passionate about, give people an experience and give them like a night away from their troubles, because that's really what this is about. The reason that we love going out and we revere these bars so much, and we talk about them with such like splendor and these like really wonderful, vivid memories, is because we were able to take our stressful lives and leave them at home and go out and spend our hard-earned money somewhere that made us feel euphoric and made us feel really good and peaceful in the moment. And that's why, as much as other people can say like, oh, you're just a bartender, it's like, no, you're creating an entire experience.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. You're creating an entire just experience about someone taking time away from the things that stress them out the most. And that's why, like, I know that this isn't, you know, one of our most like history tale driven topics. This is mostly about like the vibes and stuff that we like about this time. But there's so much parallel to back then and now. And I think when this is all over and we can all finally get together, I fully anticipate the resurgence of thematic parties, bars, pop-ups. I fully anticipate it, and I cannot wait to see what happens next. Well, this feels like a good stopping point. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk to Ann Davis on 1950s, 1960s bars after Prohibition. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Today we have with us co-author of Cocktails Across America, A Postcard View of Cocktail Culture from the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, and is aptly nicknamed the Cocktail Queen of Evergreen, Anne Davis. Anne, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. It's a pleasure to be here and speak with you and Mia.
Awesome. We're so happy to have you. So let's jump right into it. You are the co-author of this book, and you created it with Diane Lapis, who unfortunately couldn't join us today. I have to say, I love this book. It's visually stunning. It evokes a lot of classic cocktail nostalgia. It's organized in such a fantastic way that almost takes you on like a driving route and a tour of America post-Prohibition. What was your inspiration for creating this book in the first place?
The inspiration was Diane and I are vintage postcard collectors, and we collect a kind of postcard that was produced between 1931 and 1955. And one day when we were looking at our collections, we said, my goodness, there's so many bars, there's so many restaurants, there's so many clubs on these cards. Like, you know, what's the correlation? And then we realized that it almost directly coincided with repeal, and that all these places came into being because they wanted hotels, bars, restaurants wanted to welcome back people after Prohibition, and they were willing to spend a lot of money to put into place all kinds of fantasy environments and entertainments to make it appealing for people to come back and drink and hear shows and listen to music and dine and dance and have a good time all over again. And we started researching these places, and we tried to find out. I used to attend bar when I was in college, so I had the concept that we could write a book and tell this story, but it would be more interesting if we were to attach cocktail recipes to it, and that would be one more way to bring the experience to life. So that's how the combination of postcards and cocktail book came together.
Yeah, I noticed that you intersperse when you talk about a specific bar or subject matter or region, you intersperse your cocktail recipes. How did you come across those organically, or did you develop those yourself?
The recipes are primarily vintage recipes from a variety of cocktail books. And the challenge for us was to tie together the postcard, a location, and find a recipe that was associated either with that place or with that region in America. So we combed a lot of vintage cocktail books to find associated recipes. And one of the books we used quite frequently was Ted Saussure's Bottoms Up, because when he made his cocktail book in 1951, he went around the country and he asked different facilities, what's your signature drink? So if we were able to find a postcard that was of that location, then we knew it a drink that was associated with it. For example, you know, I'll give you a different example, would be the Scarlet O'Hara, which is a cocktail made with Southern Comfort. What we did in that instance is we associated it with Georgia, because that's where the author wrote the story of Gone with the Wind. And the cocktail was created after the book came out and after the movie following the book's release became so popular, and somebody decided to make a drink about Scarlett O'Hara. So there were various ways that we tied in a region and a theme and a cocktail. But sometimes, and we might get around to talking about this feature as we did previously, and that is there were technological features that occurred during the 1930s and mid-century America that affected life in cocktail bars. And so these fantastical things were created sometimes in bars and supper clubs. For example, rotational features were a new development, and they were incorporated into venues in the form of merry-go-round bars. And they were bars that turned around very, very slowly. And it became like this amazing hit draw that every barkeeper wanted to have in his bar. So there were major venues that, or hotels that would have these merry-go-round bars. And then there were, you know, smaller local bars that would also install them. So that was a feature that we found was happening during this period. For example, there was one of these bars in the Copley Hotel in Boston. Mm-hmm. There was one of them in, there's still one in the Monteleone Hotel in New Orleans. There was one in the Congress Hotel in Chicago. I mean, in the Ritz-Carlton in Atlantic City, like they were all over the place. So we thought, wow, that's a lot of fun to have that kind of feature. We wish we could go and go to these old places mm-hmm. that had these wonderful entertainments for customers. But when we researched these things, sometimes there wasn't a drink that went with it. Like we couldn't find any drink that went with any of these places or the merry-go-round bar. So we asked certain people in the industry if they would create a drink for us that would depict these themes. So some of the drinks in our book were created by mixologists like Frank Caiafa, who wrote the Waldorf Astoria Bar book, Jim Hughes, who tends bar at the Round Robin in Washington, D.C., Lucinda Sterling from Middle Branch. She formerly studied under Sasha Petrosky. But we had different people who were able to create these drinks for us.
That is wonderful that you had such a vast, network of people to go to, but also people that understood the technology, the ingredients back then. I think that's really interesting and I think a really specialized knowledge and skill. Were there any other parts of the sort of post-prohibition escapism mentality about American drinking culture that also came into effect? Like you mentioned the merry-go-round bar, were there other types of like thematic sort of like big grandiose themes happening other than like this like carnival aspect of it?
Yes, there were a lot of themes. And one of the themes was ice skating shows, because during this time, Sonia Henie, she's an Olympic ice skating champion. She won the gold medal 3 times in a row. And people couldn't get enough of her. She won the medal in 1928, 1932, and 1936. And she was so popular that she made a number of movies in Hollywood. And people across the country started having different ice shows, and they found a way to make these little rinks of ice in a hotel, and it went underneath the stage in a supper club where the orchestra was playing, and people were dancing, people were dining, everybody would take their seat, and then the ice skating rink would come out from underneath the stage, and they would put on ice skating shows for the people that were dining and drinking in these various clubs. You know, that was also extremely popular entertainment. And I would say these ice skating rinks were something like 20 by 20 feet. And they would have like a figure skating team. Then they would have a comedic act. And we were so surprised to see how prevalent this was, because they had this type of show at the St. Regis in New York. I was able to go to the St. Regis and ask them where the ice skating shows took place, and I saw the venue. The ice skating rink, of course, is no longer there. Also at the New Yorker Hotel, they had it, those kinds of shows, for well over 10 years. That is no longer there, and actually it's a recording studio where the ice skating rink and the bands used to play. But they had big bands also playing, like Tommy Dorsey and name entertainers, and they would be entertaining the people with the music, but then they would also accompany the ice skaters. So they were ice skating to the tunes of Benny Goodman, perhaps. So it was really a remarkable thing. I've seen, you know, numbers of pictures of these things also, but we found that out when we were researching, because we had never heard of that before. And it was hard to imagine that ice skating shows were taking place in these supper clubs. It's not anything like they have now. So it was very interesting. And they had shows at the Adolphus Hotel in Dallas. They had shows at the Nicolette in Minneapolis. They had shows at the Congress in Chicago and at the Conrad Hilton in Chicago. So it was an extremely popular form of entertainment, and it always sparked, in a sense, because the technology was available and because the ice skating theme became so popular, primarily spearheaded by Sonja Henie.
Wow, so they really made it a show. Like, the drinking culture, this leisure, you now have more free time outside of the house. You're not really worrying about survival as much during the Great Depression. Do you think all of this was a direct result of that time people spent penny pinching, worrying about just surviving throughout this incredibly depressive time economically? Do you think that this is... do you see sort of like that reaction to Prohibition and the Great Depression being like this fantastical, make it the biggest, most largest spectacle and make this a fun time because of what the trauma everyone went through?
Right.
Yes. I think following the stock market crash of 1929, people were, you know, almost like we are now with COVID. They were, you know, starving for socializing, something to get their mind out of the current situation that everybody was experiencing universally in the country. So these kinds of entertainments, if you could scrape up enough money to have a night out, you know, this was something that really took you to a different place. You know, in the movie theater at the time, you would be seeing Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire dancing away in a beautiful attire in these wonderful clubs in this Art Deco background, and people wanted to have that exact experience. So a lot of these venues tried to emulate that kind of an atmosphere, to give people the chance to go out and have an evening such as that. So I think that was very much important aspect to what created these fantasy environments. They had also, you know, another aspect of the time was radio. Radio started to become very popular with the ability to chain link wire broadcasts. So music could be, there could be a band playing, as I said, at the New Yorker Hotel. And that was broadcast to people's radios. So people at home could hear what was happening at the New Yorker Hotel. They could hear, you know, the band playing. They could, it was as if they were there. For example, Duke Ellington broadcasts were, he broadcasted also from the Cotton Club. So that kind of a broadcast helped form people's careers, and people at home would go out and buy the recordings. But, or they would want to go to the Cotton Club or the New Yorker Hotel when they heard Duke Ellington was playing there, or Tommy Dorsey at the New Yorker, or Benny Goodman at the Congress in Chicago. So, and it was very popular. The, you know, swing music was very popular at the time. You had at the Cotton Club, this is an, I thought was interesting, at the Cotton Club, you had primarily black entertainers that were playing to a white audience. And people would go in their finery, and you had the finest liquors. It was, the Cotton Club was open during Prohibition. It was run by a gangster, so he could get anything he wanted. And after repeal, he continued to have the finest alcohol you could have. It was a place to go and be seen. But just down the street was the Savoy Ballroom. Savoy Ballroom was, they had something called the Battle of the Bands. So you would have someone like Chick Webb and Benny Goodman, and that huge environment, and they would take turns playing, and it would be, somebody would declare the winner of the night, but the people that frequented the Savoy, where you maybe would only get beer and soda, wasn't really a drinking place, but the people that frequented it were a mixed crowd. So, you know, in the 30s, you could, you had what, white bands and black bands and white patrons and black patrons, people of color, at the Savoy, but not at the Cotton Club. So eventually it changed, and it changed because of the popularity of Duke Ellington and Cab Calloway, and finally having them insist that their policy change.
That's interesting and good to know. Do you, so you covered the 40s, 50s, and 60s in this book. Did you notice a shift in the culture after the beginning of World War II? How did those bars go from these big largesse, like grandiose celebrations of leisure time, of having more money, of not being able to drink, into sort of a war mentality?
Well, during the war, what we noticed from our postcards is that there are a lot of bars that catered to soldiers. And you would see there was a bar, there was a place called Headquarters, and then there were Ships Ahoy, and there were all these postcards where they created environments, particularly for, you know, military men and women who were, you know, being shuffled around the country to prepare for war. So that was something that happened during that time. But again, during the war, alcohol became a little bit more scarce again because, you know, production on everything was focused on the war effort. But when the war was over, during the post-war years, then things became, you know, grand again. People had money again. And so you had, by this time, you know, the I'll back up to that in a minute, but what you had also was another invention of technology in 1952 was the automatic pin setter. So you had these huge, expansive bowling alleys opening up, and all of these bowling alleys had a bar in it. So that, you know, in the evening when adults went out and bowled, they were able to go to a swanky, glitzy bar in the bowling alley and enjoy themselves. And that was pretty much how they looked. They were, you know, they were now getting into this whole idea of, you know, swanky and glitzy. So you could go and bowl a few frames and then, you know, seek some refreshment in, you know, in the bar, because all of the bowling alleys at the time had this kind of a feature. And I have to tell you, recently I was in Pittsburgh and there was a bowling alley that I went into. It didn't look like anything. You had to go in through a side entrance and you went up a dark staircase, and then the lanes were there. It looked unchanged from the 1950s. And then you went past the lanes through a corridor, and there you were at the bar. And the bar was dark, lit, you know, very atmospherically. It was like finding a time capsule. Red velvet all over the place. And they had a signature cocktail, I guess more recently created, and it was called the Big Lebowski.
Oh, which, we are.
I don't know if you're familiar with that movie, but their interpretation. Mm-hmm. So they had their own interpretation on the White Russian, the Arsenal Bowl. So it was really fun. But that was, you know, these places really existed. And I got to sort of travel back in time and experience that at this particular place. So it was a lot of fun. But also another thing I wanted to mention was Don Beach, who created the Beachcomber, Don's Beachcomber bar in L.A., and that was this whole tropical-inspired environment. He served a lot of rum drinks because he previously was a bootlegger, rum runner. And he had little money, so he, you know, put shells all over the place and nets and so forth. And he created all these rum drinks. It was immensely popular, and it was emulated by others, including Trader Vic in San Francisco. And then other people, you know, found its way across the country to the East Coast, even to the 1939-1940 World's Fair. Everybody wanted to lay claim to the zombie. And so it wasn't called Tiki, though, at the time. That's what I wanted to bring out. It wasn't till mid-century that it developed the term tiki. Before that, in the 30s, Don Beach didn't call it tiki. It was just these tropical Polynesian kind of environments that were all made up. I mean, it wasn't a real cuisine or a real drink. It was, they just made it up because people wanted to escape. They wanted to go to a different environment and experience something different. It was another fantasy environment for them, for people to go to and enjoy. So it became so popular that you could find a tropical theme bar in any part, Pennsylvania, Florida, Texas, Milwaukee, anywhere you could have, you know, find a tropical bar, still some of them exist. So, and there's of course a resurgence in the whole tiki culture. New bars are opening up with that theme all the time.
Yeah, we're gonna cover tiki. It's gonna be mostly a look on the problematic cultural appropriation aspect of it, and how, while in its heyday with Don, you know, kind of creating an atmosphere, may not have intended that, but it was pulling from different cultures of people that were invaded by the colonial militaristic nature of the United States, that appropriated a lot of different flavors, staple foods that are important to the survival of Polynesian people and the islands. and mostly just about how to move forward with it. So I think it's interesting the way that you approached sort of researching everything was on this surface level postcard of like this, because postcards are like something you would send home. It would be this like beautiful picturesque scenario of like what was going on. Like we all know when we go on vacation, it's not always wonderful and not stressful. I've yet to go on a non-stressful vacation in my adulthood, but I think it's interesting that you looked at these postcards and you thought, what's really going on here? And I love that you approached your research to looking at the surface level of just seeing this like fantastic picture and saying like, there's got to be more going on here and I want to learn all about it. And I think that's amazing. And I love that you guys put so much effort into learning not just about what was going on, but the why.
Well, we certainly enjoyed the journey and, you know, we're still researching today. There, I mean, you look at a postcard or a cocktail and you can always say, what's the background story here? Where does this come from? What's the origins of it? You know, it's a lot of fun. I mean, it's a real, both cocktails and postcards really are a road, a journey to discovering something in the past. And, you know, for Diane and I, it's like time travel.
Are there any other innovations during this time that shaped cocktail culture as we know it today? I know you touched on a lot of them, but did you ever come across your research into like maybe staples we use in cocktails today that came around during this 40s, 50s, 60s era?
Certainly. That's another aspect that our research brought to our attention, and that was vodka. You know, new things were on the market that created cocktails. For example, vodka started to become popular. You can find some drinks with vodka in it, even from the 1930s, but certainly by mid-century, that was a very popular ingredient. And also Kahlua, if you see, that came on the American market, I think around 1939. So if you see a drink with Kahlua in it, then you know that that is from post-prohibition period. So, and then also other kinds of ingredients. Tequila became more popular, you know, the margarita, the tequila sunrise. So that's also something from this period. And also other ingredients that aren't alcoholic, like, for example, cranberry juice. Ocean Spray and other cranberry juice companies wanted bartenders to use their product. They saw that bars were opening up all over the place in the post-prohibition years. And they thought, how can we get, you know, this, our product into their hands? And then, you know, more people will be familiar with it and more bartenders will buy it. So they, cocktails were created with cranberry juice in it. And the companies actually approached cocktail creators of the time, such as Trader Vic, to create cocktails that utilize cranberry juice. So that's, you know, another aspect that we noticed when we were researching our book. You know, also another thing conversely was that when we looked at certain recipes, some of those things were no longer produced. Like, for example, there's a cocktail called the Fred Harvey Southwestern Special, and it had an ingredient in it called O'Hen. O'Hen was very, very popular in New Orleans. It's anisette flavored. It was produced in Spain. And after the banning of absinthe because of the wormwood and, you know, this whole crazy thing that people were thinking, people in New Orleans turned to other anisette flavored liqueurs and imported O'Hen because it had that flavor. O'Hen then went out of production. So here we have this recipe, but we have no O'Hen. We found a substitute for it at the time, which was also produced in Spain, called anise de mano. That is also become very difficult to find at this point. But the recipe, you can, in other words, you can substitute anything that has that anisette flavor in there so you can still make the cocktail. So that was another thing that we noticed about this period of cocktail culture, is that new things were coming on the market, as well as certain things that were readily available in the post-prohibition years you could no longer find or was no longer in production. I do have to say something about O'Hen, though, because when we were in New Orleans, we found out that it was reverse engineered by the Sazerac company. So there's a new version of O'Hen that is produced here in America, and you could get it in New Orleans. But I ran out of the bottles that I brought back, and I tried to order it at my local liquor store, and he said, no, we can't get that here. So there's a whole thing that happens with ingredients, and it's interesting to see how things changed, you know, over time, with new things on the market as well as things disappearing.
So that sucks that you ran out of that. I was like, I really want to try that one, and you told me they were making it again. I was like, can I order this? And now I can't. Do you see a resurgence of some trends that happened before that are happening now? I know on your Instagram, you have Cocktails Across America Instagram, and you highlight cocktails constantly. I see you like posting recipes. Have you noticed some trends that maybe died a little bit in like the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s, but are trending back up again?
Yes, I think people have a true interest in learning about these classic cocktails and their background. Where did they first appear? So I think currently, at least in my observation, people want to delve into, you know, cocktail history, and they're very interested in these vintage cocktail books and pulling recipes from them, recreating them, finding out, you know, where they first appeared, where they were also published. So I think in response to what you were saying about Instagram is that, you know, on my Instagram site, I made a lot of friends from all over the world that have this similar interest of recreating cocktails, vintage cocktails from the past. And, you know, and also the ceremony involved with having a cocktail. Having a cocktail is an occasion. Having a cocktail is you craft it wonderfully. You might put it on a cloth napkin, and you recreate this wonderful cocktail culture that we like to think existed and probably did in many places. So it was an occasion, it was a ceremony to have a lovely cocktail. So I think that's a trend. And I mean, I can also tell you a story that really hit home for me about that feature. And I was actually in New York, and I went to meet somebody at a bar, and the meeting was over, but the bar was actually not open yet, and I wanted to have a drink before I caught my train. So I said, could you get me a Manhattan? And the bartender said, I'm not ready yet. And I thought, okay. And then I sat and I saw him get ready, and then the server came over and gave me the cloth napkin, and then a beautifully prepared Manhattan was placed in front of me, and it gave me the message. This person probably doesn't even know how much it affected me. It gave me the messages, okay, so you'll just catch another train. Like, just sit down, have your lovely cocktail, cloth napkin, let them prepare it properly, yeah, and enjoy it. So I don't know if that answered your question, but that's something that I see perhaps is different. That's one thing that I see people are changing, recreating.
Yeah, you spent so long, you know, with Diane researching, going through your postcard collections, which, by the way, hats off to you having the patience for sifting through probably thousands of postcards to find these postcards. I mean, when I go to vintage stores and I look through them, some of them are like bunnies for Easter. It's like grandma's postcards to their grandkids. It's so hard to sift through them. No, you know, not to knock grandma sending postcards, but it's a lot of stuff to sift through. But I like that you have a different way of looking at bar culture, having done all this research. And I think that's something to ask and to have you share with us. I do have one last question for you. And if you could pick any of the themes that you came across in your research to come back again, which one would it be?
I would say probably the merry-go-round bar. As I was saying before, we know of one that exists in the Hotel Monteleone, but I just thought that was so much fun. And I just, for me personally, that is one kind of trend that I would like to see return. I don't know if it's feasible or logical to have something like that now, but that's the bar that I would like to go to. Although I wouldn't mind going to supper club and getting dressed up and seeing an ice skating show either. But I guess if I have to say, I'll pick two. Those two.
At this point, I was joking with Mia about this a little while ago. I'll take a mariachi band singing happy birthday to me. Like, honestly, I'll take it. If that's my live music, I'll take it. I'll do anything to go out to a bar or enjoy something live that's interactive and entertaining. I really, really miss socializing and having these experiences at bars. Anne, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your work and everything you and Diane have done. And I love your book, and I'm going to continue enjoying reading it and trying to emulate these cocktails that you posted in your book.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm thrilled to discuss this topic with you.
Great. Okay. You can find Anne on social media. Here are the accounts. The main one is Cocktails Across America. Please follow that. On Twitter, it's Cart Postel. That's Cart with an E. And Cart Postel 3, so CartePostale 3. And Diane, who is the co-author of Cocktails Across America, can be found on Instagram at Today and Cocktail History. And thank you again so much for joining us. We cannot wait to make all of these cocktails, post them all on our Instagram, do the recipe reels, and see what you think of what we do with your creations in the future.
Thank you so much.
And Anne, we'll see you at the merry-go-round bar when we make one in New York.
Yeah, I hope that comes back.
Well, thank you guys. That was so much fun. Let's hopefully all escape to a far, far away bar somewhere soon together.
Coin up.
This has been Drink History.
Sorry.
It's been Drink History. I'm your host, Alexa Wilkinson.
And I'm your co-host, Mia Fiorito.
And this is Drink History.
We were actually on it this time.
We weren't. There's a lag.
Oh, damn it. Well, never mind.
Drink History is produced by me, Alexa Wilkinson, and our theme song is by Blue Topaz. Episodes will be released every Wednesday and distributed by Anchor.fm. Visit drinkhistorypodcast.com for more info and help us out by sharing and rate and listen where all podcasts are available. And also feel free to leave a voicemail on Anchor and let us know how you feel about the show or just any questions or comments for us. We'd love to hear from you. All right, folks, cheers.